assistant professor at the Department of Geopolitics and International Relations at Manipal Academy of Higher Education. She holds a PhD in Chinese studies from Jawaharlal Nehru University. Her research interests are China's foreign policy, the PLA, security and strategic issues in India, China, and China-Japan relations, as well as the Indo-Pacific. Dr. Church has authored the concept of active defense in China's military strategy at Pentagon Press 2021. We have with us Mr. M.B. Rappai, who will be chairing this session. Mr. Rappai is a Delhi-based security analyst specializing in Asian strategic issues. He is also an honorary fellow at the Institute of Chinese Studies. Before we begin, I would like to lay out some housekeeping rules that every participant must mute themselves during the event. And if anyone wants to pose a question, they can write the question in the chat box, or they can use the raise hand option. And that's all. Over to you, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Partho. Thank you for that introduction. And I think I will just briefly introduce the subject and then I will hand over the mic to Amrita. Since 1949, I think the military has revised some major 9 different military strategies they have brought in. And they are, the active defense came into being in September 1980, the General Strategic Department done a long meeting for 1 month, and then they introduced the active defense. Active defense, if we go back to Chinese military thinking, it is nothing new. Because apart from that, that I will pause a minute, and because we have a very big tradition, long tradition in the Chinese military thinking, starting with Sun Tzu's Art of War and 7 military classics and a series of writings over the time. But I will not get into the details now. So active defense was in 50s also, they mentioned, but that time, I think after the Pangtao-Hoi schism in 1959, they left it at that, and then they revived it in 1980, September. That was mainly to safeguard their border with the then Soviet Union. It's a very open and long border. So they said, we will not wait the enemy to come in and corner them, but we will defend at our convenience. And basically that was the theme they thought about active defense at that time. And there was the Deng Xiaoping just came, took over. So there was a lot of things happening during that period. But one thing we have to understand, the Chinese military system evolved over a long period of time. Even if we look at Indian military thinking, it is the offensive or killing was not the first change. It was to defend oneself, or in the modern sense, if I call it deterrence, how to deter the enemy. So the concern was how to defend the country and at the same time avoiding a war. That even Sun Tzu talks a lot about avoiding a war. A general who is the best, that one who don't fight a war, because he must be in a position to win a war without fighting it. So then they can retain the riches of the country. That is why they always given very stress to preparedness, how to prepare. So Sun Tzu's one way he starts his work as war is a question of vital importance to the state. It is a matter of life and death, the road to survival and ruin. Therefore, it cannot be left to the, we used to say, it cannot be left to the military alone. It needs a close study and a decision making at a larger level of the now we can say that whatever the knowledge base accumulated at the national level. then only one can go for that such a decision. And Amrita has brought out the book, so I will not get into the discussion of the book now, because later hear from her on the first hand, then we will have a full discussion about it. I think I welcome all the participants, and Amrita, to you.
Thank you very much, sir. At the very outset, I would like to thank the Institute of Chinese Studies and especially Professor Alka Acharya for giving me this opportunity to discuss on a subject, as Rabbi sir already put it, that it's not new. Active defense is nothing new. But what is quite stark to believe is that there's no single document so far which talks or which has researched on this subject, that is exploring into active defense in China's military strategy, except for Professor Taylor Frevel's book, which is also a recent edition. And my objective towards pursuing this research was specifically given, we are in India and we face a border dispute with China. So it gives us, first and foremost, that's my first reason why to pursue this subject. And secondly, to base my research on a very inquiry mode. And what struck my initial thought process to pursue this was certain key queries. Firstly, unlike the United States, we see China doesn't issue any national document which suggests national military strategy. But does that mean that China doesn't have a military strategy? That was my question, that can we have such linear assumptions? Or the next step was, because we cannot believe that China doesn't have a military strategy, if to go with that belief, then what comprises this Chinese military strategy? What goes into the military thinking or the Chinese military thinking? It was mainly to tap this objective, and in doing so, I made this humble attempt to come up with a book, and titling is At the Concept of Active Defense in China's Military Strategy. So please note that I didn't call active defense as a military strategy, rather I'm saying the concept of active defense. So there's a clear-cut distinction I would like to bring into perspective. Now, before jumping into what active defense means, the main query lies in understanding how does China perceive strategy, or what China calls it as Chanlui? Or is there a difference in thinking when you talk of China's military strategy? So what I found that in Chinese, the word strategy or like Chanlui or military strategy, that is Chunshi Chanlui, is actually used interchangeably. So that became my first finding, that when you use interchangeably, then what is the thinking? So I went into the definition of strategy as per the Science of Military Strategy NDU book in 1999. They clearly suggest the strategy is nothing but planning and guidance for the overall situation of military struggle, including planning, deploying, guiding, and use of military force to reach the effective achievements of a stated political objective. And when they tried to just interpret military strategy, it was defined as a set of function and stratagems that guides this comprehensive war effort. So this was the broad idea that was set in. So when I started reading this definitions and tried to extrapolate that, is there some similarity? What I found is that in Chinese practice, the use of strategy and military strategy are predominantly interchangeably used. So this therefore gives it the fact that it's driven from an idea that unlike the United States, just China does not have separate terms for strategy, national security strategy, national defense strategy, and national military strategy. So this lack of distinction therefore brings or highlights two key aspects of Chinese thinking. That is, firstly, there is a monolithic way of perception that is all-encompassing. And secondly, that the element of ambiguity, there's an element of ambiguity which makes this Chinese understanding of strategy or military strategy appear to be abstract. And therefore, we come across these anticipations. We often come across these anticipations of how does China think. So this was one of the findings that I got, that what probes into or what calls for this uncertainty is the very use, that when you use interchangeably, one needs to understand that strategy in Chinese interpretation at the foremost is military strategy in their mind. The second aspect was then to decode the military strategic guideline, which is called as Chun Shi Chan Lui function. Why I'm using this is that, you know, these forms the bedrock of active defense. So I'll come to active defense a little later, but just giving a primer prior to that. So when I was understanding military strategic guideline, I tried to get the definition from the PLA's glossary, and which defines that it's the core and collected embodiment of military strategy. So please, you know, to mind you that, you know, it is not saying that MSG is a military strategy. And in particular, it contains the program and principles of planning and guiding the overall situation of war in a given period. So this is a broad understanding of military strategic guideline. And in this, the underlying principle, therefore, is based on strategic thoughts. So that is, military strategic guidelines are based on certain strategic thoughts, which China, in Chinese parlance, it's called Chan Lue Zi Xiang. That is the basic viewpoints for guiding and planning the overall situation of military struggle. So this is where the idea of strategic thoughts or concepts came, you know, into being. So when I look back into the usage of strategic concepts, predominantly we see that in Chinese military thinking, since Mao Zedong, we see certain key ideas which have been very dominant. Active defense being one of them, that is Qi Qi Fang Yu. Apart from that, when any Mao's discourse that you read, you cannot, you know, give an oversight to the concept of people's war or protracted war or guerrilla warfare. But in the current context, if we see, we don't see people's, these concepts, that is people's war, guerrilla warfare, are not used, or they don't make appearances in the Chinese military thinking in the current times. But what has stayed or remained is that of active defense. So unlike other concepts, active defense, we are seeing a continuity in the thinking. So this became my second finding, that, you know, how do I then extrapolate active defense in China's military thinking? So this is to give you a broad background to what went into this study. Now, when I tried to draw a broad framework, I could assess that, you know, strategy in China is driven by concepts. And so, like, for instance, China's national strategy in today's time predominantly is driven by the concept of Chinese dream. When you talk of China's security strategy, or China's core interest is the concept that drives that. So always, you know, China's core interest is where the red flags lie. So it's the only country, you know, that makes a difference, core interest versus national interest. So core interest always supersedes. And finally, China's military strategy, that's where I figured active defense as the key concept that drives this thinking. And as to go with what I said earlier, that it's not new. So what makes it an old concept? So it dates back to Mao Zedong's, you know, first prescription of active defense, which he put forward in 1936. And in that, as I quote him, he said, active defense is also known as offensive defense, or defense through decisive engagements. And the only real defense is active defense. So in this entire definition. Mao Zedong is spelling. He spelled out offense. He spelled out decisive engagements. And he also calls it as the real defense. So nowhere do you find this, that he is putting forward a very defensive viewpoint. There is an element of offense. But in the normal understanding or in the common understanding, often active defense is thought of as a defensive strategy. So this also became my point of inquiry, that is active defense really defensive? If not, then where is that offensive element, or how to construe that offensive element? So I tried to find some writings from PLA officers, and one of them, Colonel Wang Naiming, he posited that the strategic thinking of active defense, as he said, that stresses that strategic guidance should be in a planned way, have the initiative and be flexible. And he stresses that active and not passive military action. And this fully meets the requirements of modern warfare. So to allude to you, he often, we say that, you know, whether China's action was premeditated. Yes, there is a planned thinking to Chinese action. It is not all of a sudden. And there's a flexibility to the Chinese action. So in flexibility in terms of scope and scale of the force or use of force in that way. And very well, it puts out that the stress element is on the active part, but not on passive military action. So this then became, this then gave me some clarity of how non-defensive or how offensive is active defense to interpret it. But the clarity came with the 2015 white paper. So from Mao Zedong to 2015 white paper, the first time that China issued a document and named the defense white paper as China's military strategy. And in that, again, for the first time, it spelled out that active defense is the essence of CPC's military strategic thought. So this was enough an evidence to suggest that what is the Chinese thinking. So when you are, firstly, it put forward and with clarity, as well as it narrowed down specifically on what China means by strategy and how it sees active defense in that discourse. The three dimensions that were laid out under this active defense was, firstly, adherence to the unity of strategic defense and operational and tactical offense. The second was that of adherence to principles of defense, self-defense in post-emptive strike. And finally, adherence to the stance that we will not attack unless we are attacked, but we will surely counter-attack if attacked. If you see, there's a resonance back in 1962 with Mao Zedong also used that, you know, the in war against India, the counter was that of in self-defense, counter-attack. So how do you then interpret this counter-attack? But the idea that China or the military strategy guideline posted was that of post-emptive strike. But Chinese actions, does it only clarify for post-emptive? And isn't there any scope for preemption? Was again, the other aspect of my inquiry. So what I found in the 2020 defense white paper, DOD report of the US Congress, they suggested that China's military strategy is based on active defense, which is a concept that adopts the principles of strategic defense in combination with offensive action at the operational and tactical level. So this is where the one needs to look out for, the combination of offensive action. And therefore, it is neither purely defensive strategy nor limited to territorial defense. What it rather encompasses is an offensive and preemptive aspect. So this, therefore, brings in the, or tries to give you some explanation into whether active defense is just defensive. So this clarifies it. Now, one of the key concepts, therefore, going back to the military strategy guideline, which I started with, it says that over time, we see that, you know, since 1949 till date, there had been nine, China has issued nine military strategic guidelines, the current being winning informationized local wars. So what has been the interpretation of active defense? Active defense has only been adjusted. That is, the content of active defense has been adjusted over time in these military strategic guidelines. To tell you, in 1980, that is under Deng Xiaoping, they named the military strategic guideline itself as active defense. That was for the first time that they pronounced it. Howsoever, over time, active defense has been very consistent in Chinese thinking. So, for instance, if I draw from the 2002 defense white paper, it suggests that China implements a military strategy of active defense, wherein strategically China pursues a principle featuring defensive operations, self-defense, and attack only after being attacked. And in response to the profound changes in the world's military field and the requirements of the national development strategy, China has formulated a military strategy guideline of active defense in the new period. The guideline is based on winnings. So since I'm quoting 2002, the military strategy guideline was winning local wars under modern, especially high-tech conditions, which since 2014 is now changed to winning informationized local wars. So from 2002 to the 2015 white paper to the 2019 white paper, what we have seen that this concept of active defense has been readjusted given the situation. So post Cold War, this defense has been articulated in a security environment that is post Cold War, post Gulf War, and post 9/11 security matrix. Therefore, what has been changed is from winning informationized or winning local wars under modern high-tech conditions, we see that only informationized has been added. The local war stays, the winning stays, and now what we call it, and China is added another element of that of intelligentized warfare in the current state of affairs. So this has been the transition over time. And it was well available by reading into the white papers itself to understand the evolution of the concept. So therefore, when China says that active defense is the essence of CPC's military strategic thought, it provided two key clarifications, which helps us somewhat to dispel the ambiguity which has often been attached to the understanding of active defense. That is, firstly, that active defense is a strategic concept. So it clarifies that it is neither China's military strategy, nor is it the strategic guideline. So this is the first clarification. Secondly, the very description to say that it is the essence of the military thinking, it further clarifies that active defense or the concept adopts the systematic hierarchy among Chinese war fighting principles. So it's actually at the apex when you talk of military thinking. And from this, I could deduce two assessments. That is, firstly, that active defense holds an element of superiority in terms of shaping both the military strategic guideline and the military strategy, but not otherwise. And the second aspect is that, unlike the changing nature of military strategic guidelines, which we had so far nine military strategic guidelines, and its impact on the military strategy, the concept of active defense has been a constant determinant, which only changes in terms of applicability. So therefore, my starting point was from that of Mao Zedong, quoting Mao Zedong, and then coming down to that of the 2015 white paper. So there has been a continuity in China's thinking. It's only the interpretation and the usage that has differed over time. So what, therefore, we can construct, can be stated that active defense has remained relatively constant, but the content of the concept is what has evolved, and it has evolved with the changes in the response, in the Chinese response to the emerging security environment, which therefore is compounded with adapting to technological advancement for the PLA to the fight, to fight modern warfare. So to put into perspective, active defense therefore has transformed from Mao Zedong to Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping. That is what was under Mao, luring the enemy in deep. That was the principle or the guiding thought process in active defense. Then under Deng Xiaoping, it became positional warfare of fixed defense. That there was a fixed territory where you were fighting, but it was within the Chinese territory. So from Mao to Deng, you see, for under Mao, it is you lured the enemy in deep. That is, you're luring enemy into the Chinese territory. And secondly, under Deng Xiaoping, it was positional warfare, but in Chinese territory and in a limited scope, limited geographical scope. But today's China, as we understand, the active defense is that of forward defense. I'll come back to explaining what forward defense means, but this is what is the current interpretation of active defense. So in the current context, therefore, China's practice of active defense calls for a quick reaction. Quick reaction before the enemies are ready to strike, and preferably on their own territory. To draw some corollary, we saw that, you know, in the current Chinese military response to Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, it was quick. It was a quick response. The response was a military response, deter any kind of threat. And a quick response even before the enemy strikes. So even before Taiwan or US attack, China responded. So this is where you see the practical applicability of active defense. So this action-oriented approach is therefore based on two key objectives. When you talk about forward defense, it entails two key objectives. That is, firstly, when you're fighting the enemy beyond your borders or beyond your territory, China is able to minimize damage to China's own infrastructure by conducting the war in enemy's backyard. So you fight the enemy in their backyard, but not in your own backyard. So that is the first clarification. Secondly, to create a psychological or political shock to the enemy by upsetting the adversary's strategy and expectations, and acquiesce into a new status quo that is more favorable to China. This is again well proven today. Under, you know, China's military exercises and drills, China has already crossed the median line. So the status quo is already broken. Earlier, there was a tacit understanding between China and Taiwan that no one crosses the median line. But the median line today stands, you know, already crossed by China. So there is a new status quo that is there, wherein China now conducts military exercises beyond the median line. So this is then the action-oriented approach of active defense under its forward defense, understanding, that's the thing. So therefore, when we look into from this two perspectives, it highlights, firstly, China has continuously adjusted its active defense policy based on its perception of the strategic balance of the international security environment, as well as its own domestic political and economic situation. Why do I add this domestic political situation or economic situation? Because today's China is a confident China, and its military aspires or dreams of being the world-class military. It is far more advanced. It's a modernized it's a modern military force. So therefore, today's PLA is completely different from the PLA of Mao Zedong, under Mao Zedong, as well as that of Deng Xiaoping, and to that of Chiang Zemin or Hu Jintao. Under today's PLA, of course, has shed the dictum of Deng Xiaoping's dictum of playing a very, that is hiding your capabilities and biding your time. China no more believes in that. China believes in projecting its capabilities. So forward defense, therefore, dovetails that fact that there is no there is no hesitance. PLA is not hesitant to expose or demonstrate its military muscle in safeguarding its interests. And in doing so, it wants to do so by fighting the enemy beyond its own territory, as well as setting new status quo. Now, the new status quo, unlike just like Taiwan, we are also seeing that along the India-China border. So there is, a clear reflection of how active defense is practiced by the Chinese military. So specifically pointing at active defense as forward defense, this is the key adjustment that has been made to active defense in the current form, unlike its explanation in the past. Because China now expanded the battle space beyond China's borders to increase China's strategic depth. So there is a clear-cut intention. Why are you going, or why do you want to fight the enemy beyond your territory? Because in doing so, you also increase your own strategic depth, which you will not get if you're fighting the enemy within your territory. So this is an advantage that you get. Secondly, so therefore, this has redefined the foundational understanding of active defense, that is luring the enemy in deep, which was the basic, the first form of understanding of active defense. And in Science of Military Strategy, the 2013 edition, it states that given the new changes in the world's military development in terms of content, the military strategy must break through the traditional strategic thinking of simply defending the soil of the border areas and actively and steadily pursue forward defense. So it is just there in their military books, in their military thinking. So that is, it is in clear interest of China to take the defense beyond its borders. And it's also a reflection of a departure from the traditional thinking that China had. So this therefore calls for pushing the first line away from China's borders and coast to ensure that combat occurs beyond China's homeland territory, not on or within it. So making China's borders and coast to be viewed as interior lines and not exterior. So this also gives a different interpretation as to how China sees its territorial borders as well as its maritime borders. So under this understanding, they are now treated as interior lines and not exterior. So you can transcend that. So when I try to see that how active defense effort acts as a guideline in China's, in PLA's military posture, there are certain clear-cut conditionalities that has that guides the PLA's both posture as well as thinking. So there's firstly, it says that our military strategy is defensive, where we attack only after being attacked. But the emphasis point, what China attaches is that, but our operations are offensive. So this is again lays down that our operation has to be offensive, not defensive. The second precept is that the counter-offensive will not be limited by space or time. So there is no aspect of positional defense. So there is this further clarifies the aspect of forward defense. So there is no limitations in terms of what China considers to be the space or the duration of how long. So that is completely at the prerogative of the Chinese military apparatus. So then comes that the PLA will not push or put the boundaries on the limits of our offensives. This is the third. Fourth is that the PLA will not wait for the time and conditions that favors the forces when we do initiate offensive operations. So the current Taiwan acts were very much dovetails this, that China didn't wait for the conditions. The conditions were not conducive for China, yet China did go with that offensive plan. Then comes that we'll focus on opposing forces' weaknesses. So that also brought into picture that, you know, if China is instituting a military response, it was also a way of testing the opponent here, both Taiwan and US, for that matter, that, you know, what can be their response? So in a way, seeing their weaknesses as well. Will there be a prompt response against China's action? To which we saw there was no direct, you know, counter response. Then comes that we'll use our own forces to eliminate the enemy's forces. That is integrity of the PLA, not any foreign force, but the PLA. Then offensive operations against the enemy and defensive operations for our own force protection will be conducted simultaneously. That is, how do you strike the balance between offense and defense? That is, you launch an offense against the enemy, but yet you keep on safeguarding your own operations. So you have to strike that balance. And finally, maximize the advantages against the opposing forces. So this brings in the calculus of the Chinese thinking on how the PLA has to act in a time of contingency or not a contingency. So overall, what should be the PLA's military posture? So when I try to draw some linkages of it from science of military strategy, there were certain four pillars that I could extrapolate of active defense. Firstly, that China will not fire the first shot and will attempt to settle any dispute by peaceful means for as long as possible. This has been a clear-cut principle. If you've seen, you know, on Taiwan also, China talks about peaceful reunification and, you know, force. But that doesn't mean that they denounce force. That's over and all, it has been cleared, as also specified under the 20th Party Congress. Secondly, China will attempt to deter war militarily or politically before it breaks out. So the first option is always military. Then, you know, there is a political wing to it, but it says that it will attempt to deter any kind of war first militarily. The third is China will respond to an attack with offensive action and will seek to destroy the enemy's forces. So this again clarifies that any action that China will take has to be decisive. So today when Xi Jinping says that fight and win, his emphasis is that the PLA is not just ready or capable of fighting, but there is a condition that you have to win. So this further dovetails with this third pillar. And finally, the fourth pillar is that which is mainly under the nuclear usage of nuclear weapons. It says that China would not be the first state to use or threaten to use nuclear weapons. So this the nuclear option actually doesn't become that important when you talk about the China's response to the threat, because it's also bounded by the no first use principles. But the first three are very significant in understanding China's behavior. So, and also you need to note, active defense is not just an immediate response, it's also a response over time. So when China says that my first reaction will be not firing a bullet, but to settle any dispute by peaceful means, it is the first precondition that is attaches, which we have seen based on both Taiwan as well that of the India-China boundary dispute. So this is the peaceful note. But that doesn't delineate that China will not use force. This is what one needs to keep into account. So when we do an overall understanding, we can say that active defense therefore posits a strategically defensive orientation for the PLA. So strategically it does, but specifically it instructs the PLA to engage in operationally offensive action in order to thwart an invader. So this is the main, or you know, can say the blueprint that we can say which is given to the PLA, that you have to have a strategic defensive orientation. That is the benchmark, but you have to be engaged operationally. So today when Xi Jinping talks about or harps on that PLA has to be combat ready, it means that you have to be operationally active and offensive in action. And there were certain key tenets that I could draw of active defense from the various white papers. Some of the tenets that I'd like to discuss is, first is adhere to a position of self-defense and stay with striking back. So this is, so when I'm talking of tenets, I'm actually taking into the picture over time of active defense. So this, when you talk of position of self-defense, here it entails defensive counterattacks in response to an attack. So there is a complete surety that if you attack China, there will be a counterattack. There is no two ways to that. Second is combine strategic defense with operational and tactical offense. So this involves two approaches. That is, active defense involves offensive campaigns, operations, and tactical actions in support of strategic defense. And they may occur rapidly and along external lines. That is, in today's time, we can say that, you know, what China considers beyond the borders. Secondly, it uses strategic defense to weaken the enemy and set the conditions to transition into strategic offense in order to secure victory. This is the second idea behind combining strategic defense. The third tenet talks about taking the operational initiative. This is what is significant, because this aspect emphasizes, that is, the effective use of offensives at the operational and tactical levels, avoiding enemy strengths and concentrating on building asymmetric advantages against enemy weaknesses to change what is inferior into what is superior. And this is what has been China's practice over time. The fourth such tenet is strive for the best possibility, that is, maximize, you know, gain greater advantages. That is, importance of setting conditions in advance, and suggests that preferable to be prepared and not fight than to fight unprepared. So you have to be combat ready. You need to be ready for any kind of possibilities that we are seeing in the current PLA's posture. The fifth is that of dialectical unity of restraining war and winning war. That is, both you intend both to avert any kind of war situation, and if not avert, you have to win the war. So there are two ways. So the military posture has to be any kind of threat that can lead to war, and if there is a war, you have to win the war. So there is, has to be a preparedness in this. And finally, it says soldiers and the people are the source of victory. So it's mainly on the people's war perspective that the focus is on. That is, national mobilization that we see and participation in wartime as a whole of nation concept of warfare. So it is not just the PLA fighting, but having that adage to it of national mobilization. And we have seen this in, you know, any white paper you take or document or Chinese leadership speeches, they all talk about national mobilization, not PLA's mobilization or national defense. That is how it has been construed in the Chinese thinking. So if I have to interpret, put it in Chinese words, that whether to understand that the active aspect of active defense, I would like to cite Senior Colonel Chang Yu Kuo of PLA, who said that, as I quote him, Some countries adopt preemptive strategies, emphasizing preemptive intervention and taking initiative in attack. Ours is totally different. Being active is only a kind of means, and defense is a fundamental purpose. So this is how he has put it in a very cryptic way, what active defense means. So rather than what, and very much puts into perspective that, you know, what other countries call preemptive strategies. So there is a preemptive element in active defense. So the final query that I was trying to case through my book is that, is how is active defense defensive? And my finding was that active defense is not just defensive. And the most significant aspect to say so or note is that the trigger aspect, which qualifies the offensive or the proactive component in active defense. That is to suggest that while the basic tenet of this concept, you know, it calls for PLA to engage in strategic defense and not strike first, but it also means that in active defense, such a defensive posture is possible only when combined with an offensive operational posture, right? You cannot have, you can have this objective of, you know, a counterattack if you're not operationally active. Hence the term, therefore I say that the term active, or how do you explain this active in the active defense? Therefore, the key aspect that qualifies China's offense at any given time is this trigger factor. That is, what will trigger or what can trigger China to see a threat? And I argue that China's military response need not be an opponent's military action. And the, and again, drawing from the recent military drills in Taiwan, it again proves that what military response need not be against a military action. There was no military action against China, but the China responded militarily. It can be opposed to any hostile political, economic, or strategic action that China interprets as a threat, thus justifying China's military response to an opponent's action. So Taiwan, therefore, is a very well-proven case in that way. So when you say means, ways, and ends, therefore, active defense becomes the ways with towards achieving a purpose, that is the military strategy guideline of local wars under informationized or now intelligized conditions, and the objective being to fight future wars away from China's territory. And the means, therefore, is deep strikes, a concentration of superior firepower that is to be utilized to destroy the opponent's retaliatory capabilities through preemptive strikes, employing long-range artillery, short-range ballistic missiles, and precision-guided munitions. So now you see that, you know, how China is building its arsenal. Precision is the key word to that. So to implement, therefore, active defense, the PLA, as China thinks, should judge threats accurately. Because as we have seen, that China's action, China believes in having a decisive action. That is, there is no space for loss, but you have to win. So you need to judge the threat accurately. Secondly, you prepare for a defensive war in a targeted fashion. And we are seeing that if China's goals, you know, the goals that is mechanization, modernization, informationization, and finally 2050 calling for world class military, it's also a preparation in a targeted fashion. Thirdly, stick to the principle of sticking back and striving for victory only after the enemy has struck. This is the foundational principle. But we have seen that, you know, China can take or preempt or have a military response even despite the threat not being that of military in nature. And fourthly, be agile in reacting to circumstances. So again, in case of Taiwan, we saw an agile PLA that, you know, from the Eastern Military Command, that the entire theatrization that we that we witnessed in China's military exercises, the agility in terms of jointness is therefore what clarifies how active defense will be implemented or is implemented in PLA's warfighting skills. So the insights that one draws is that although defensive in purpose, active defense seeks to take the initiative and stay on the offensive from a conflict's earlier stages in order to bring hostilities to a swift conclusion. So this again got under Taiwan. So just 1 minute more. Yeah. And Beijing's therefore maintains an opacity over offensive operations. So this very fact is inherent in active defense. So without any further ado, I can take the queries during the Q&A session. But I'd like to submit that the active defense, which was in its earlier form, has undergone a huge transition, because what earlier China perceived an attack that was against any kind of invasion. Today, that kind of threat is gone. China doesn't face any kind of threat of invasion. Therefore, the applicability of active defense has changed. And as Mao rightly put it, that active defense is offensive defense. So on that note, thank you for your patience here.
Thank you, Amrita. Actually, I think after listening to you, I don't think we have to panic immediately, but it's better to know the caution and be prepared for whatever is coming.
Sorry for taking that extra time.
Yeah, no problem. But I think you've given us a description and tried to justify the active, but active defense is also China's defense posture. We also have to understand that you yourself put it, the resources, the military's yes. technology level, and the preparedness. So all these things, I think it gives an ample time for a neighbor like us to understand and keep our powder dry. At the same time, as you said, because taking war is not that easy. Waging a war is not that easy. Even that is why if you looked at the current Taiwan issue also, despite the Nancy Pelosi's visit, China didn't do, of course, they have to move some or make some noises. Otherwise, the world will pursue them in a different way. That is why they stopped immediately or tried to keep it limited and the operations. But I think I'll open the floor and allow the people to ask more questions. I don't want to make a speech, long speech.
Thank you, sir. Just to add to that, I failed to add it actually. That's what is called the Goldilocks policy, that, you know, just it, neither too much, neither too less. So that was well suited. So China knows that, you know, I tore that line, but it was enough to deter. So,
because as you didn't elaborate on nuclear, but if you look at their nuclear strategy, because they know, they are aware about who they are aiming at or who their enemies are. So they didn't go for a, you know, they don't want to spend all the money on nuclear deterrence, and keep it there, keep their natural resources preserved and their economic resources. So that was very clear, China taking a position to defend itself at the same time to deter the enemy. I think I will request Parthu to see if any questions came or if anybody otherwise can raise the hands and ask questions to Amrita.
Yes, sir. As of now, there are no questions posted in the chat box. So we have Idham Ashraf.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think I will request Idham Ashraf to put that question.
Hi. Hello, thank you very much for that presentation. I really enjoyed listening to the synopsis in that sense. There were two aspects that interest me, and that's because one of the things that was mentioned initially was that there wasn't any defense paper as such, that the military side of China that they presented. But then recently, the white papers, which have now emerged, which was mentioned, does the authors think of them as coming from a place of confidence that this is the new China, which is confident enough to put out their military strategy in terms of this is how we are now seeing it, or we are now going to consider the military strategy part of us, and or it is a natural phenomenon, part of the global environment, because they are addressing or they're trying to imitate another state, like, for example, the American white, you know, military strategy, or they're copying them or what. And the second point I wanted to make was a very important point that was mentioned, was about the operational defense, because one of the things China lacks is their lack of operational experience. Recently, for example, in the UK, it's emerged that they found British military pilots within the PLA training after retirement, training some of their pilots there. So that was an interesting aspect, that they lack that experience, if you may like, apart from the individual cases with the Indian forces on the border, they lack that experience, and that shows. So I just wanted to get the opinion. Thank you very much.
So may I?
Yeah, you can.
Thank you for those queries. Yes, I think that it is a combination of both the external environment as well as a confident China, because you have to see the white paper that says China's military strategy comes under Xi Jinping in 2015. And Xi Jinping has given that picture that China is, today's China is a confident China. So it is not shying away from projecting its military capabilities. And we have seen that in every quarter of wherever we see this, you know, flashpoints, be it South China Sea. It is under Xi Jinping that went into fortification of the islands, be it East China Sea, calling for ADIZ, or, you know, the India-China border dispute that has got ramped up under various standoffs from 2014 till, of course, the Eastern Ladakh standoff since 2020, or Taiwan. So it is a confident China. And also, you know, this idea that China is not operationally prepared, and citing that the last war China fought was 79, we need to get over that viewpoint. Today's PLA, if it is not prepared, why would it expose or demonstrate or take that risk? Today's China is also a risk taker, but it is very well calibrated and calculated how much risk it's going to take. So I would beg to differ that, you know, China has less operational skills. It is building its skills, of course. So we cannot give an oversight to that. So this is my submission.
Yeah, thank you. I think the use of British pilots is mainly, I think China is lacking the capability to use their aeroplanes from the sea, because they have now three military aircraft carriers. But to land an aeroplane on an aeroplane carrier is almost a technology different. They have few pilots trained, but they need more experience. Pilots in that is why they are looking at the pilots from British Navy, which is operating a lot of aircraft carriers, or they have the rich experience in using the aircraft carriers and landing on board and taking off from the aircraft carriers. Yeah, I think you can take on the other next question, or you can use the chat box. Yeah.
Yes, we have a few questions from Mr. Amit Dogra. I would read it out. Can we apply the active defense concept to the Chinese action in the South China Sea and in the Indian Ocean as a part of MSR? Also, as we witness Chinese incursions in Indian territory in Ladakh, the new buffer zone is what China wanted to achieve, or is it just a good bargain?
Thank you for that question, to Dogra. Applying active defense concept to the Chinese, yes, because it is building your defenses. As I said, in the general understanding, active defense is about strengthening your defenses. That is, and also fighting. When we talk about that forward defense, so fortification of the islands puts into perspective what China is talking about. It's not luring the enemy indeed, but fighting the enemy beyond your borders. So China has already defined that those maritime areas are also its interiors, not an exterior. So in that aspect, yes, active defense does comply to the South China Sea, or the larger, if you want to say, the Belt and Road project under MSR specifically. The second aspect of Chinese incursions in Indian territory, isn't it already, like I've already given example to that, you know, be it Taiwan or India-China border, China does practice, which is well laid out. It's not something very new. That happened in 1962 also, when I cited Mao Zedong's idea of his self-defense, or the counter-attack and the self-defense also was part of active defense. And today, when we are seeing Galwan clash, it is not defensive, but there was an act of offense, and which China perpetrated, so that it sets into it. So in my opinion, yes, active defense in India-China boundary.
Yeah, thank you. Amrita, the problem, I think, as any queries, I will broad you into two more aspects. It is easy to say about Galwan or India border, but incidentally, today is 19, tomorrow is the 60th anniversary of the China India-China war. Of course, I think whether to a Chinese audience, I would have put it differently, but to an Indian audience, we also have to do our soul search. Have we learned our lessons, or are we prepared to understand this whole thing? I will not get into the detail, but I would like to certainly get your experience and your knowledge about, because you are young and you researched on various aspects.
So definitely, when you have a threat like China, like we have transcended from calling China a challenge, but militarily China is a threat. So first we need to bring a distinction of what do you mean by a threat and a challenge. And then building your defenses, isn't it natural for India to build its defenses or defense capabilities? Because often, that is, as prior to the discussion, I was saying, the sighting, that be it Doklam or in Eastern Ladakh, the often way of surprise element is it doesn't fare well. So one needs to, especially a country like India, where China is an imminent threat, you need to build your military capabilities to match that of a threat. We had long been, obsessed with Pakistan, but China is a different rival or, threat altogether. We cannot draw similarities. And also that calls for change in a mindset in terms of building our capabilities. That's where I would like to submit.
Amrita, it is interesting because I know you are a much younger generation than me. Even I was very young when the Chinese war happened. So I was in the primary school, but I would like to know that our military. I'm not talking about military alone in the whole of India. Even you put it Pakistan, but even our knowledge about Pakistan, I think Alka can clarify more. Are we investing enough resources in understanding? You leave us a military for a minute. Even as a country, its political system, its decision-making, is how the top leadership is working. And then after, once you know about the political leadership, then only you can think about the military leadership. So I think we need to think a little more broadly about at least the neighbors who matters for us.
Yes, I totally agree to that, sir. And also being a student of Chinese studies, we have often seen that you know, to put it like we like to have a superficial understanding rather than, you know, going in depth. And specifically for us, our threats are on either side of the border. On Pakistan, you know, given our similarities in which it's easy to understand. But to understand China, it's a much bigger, like there is a bigger challenge. And it's already like we have been neighbors for too long and still we are trying to say, oh, the China puzzle or China thing today, like, you know, decoding China. A country like India, we should have decoded China long back rather than, you know, United States or other European countries. Given the very fact we share a border, we are neighbors, we are part of the same continent and also having historical linkages. So I totally agree that, you know, we need to invest more in doing in-depth research and knowing China, you know, by investigating into the Chinese understanding of things. That is also very important. That is rather the most important aspect of understanding. So
I think I would request Alka if you want to come in and give us some knowledge.
No knowledge, just a simple question actually. So it was really a very a great learning experience for me, Amrita. I don't normally get into these kinds of issues. I prefer to get onto the politics and other issues. So yeah, thank you very much. That was a very interesting talk. And I mean, what is the point of really breast beating and go on to this angsty level of, you know, why isn't there more attention given to the development of China studies? Why aren't there more universities studying China? Why aren't we investing more? I mean, all my life I have spent as, you know, teaching and guiding research and being part of various fora where we are talking about how to promote China studies. It just seems we are saying the same things. And now already three generations have passed by, my teachers, me, and now the third generation, which is you all that are now in the fray, are saying the same things, are, you know, wringing their hands about the same thing. So I don't know. It's just that either there is a complete myopia about what is going to be our biggest challenge stroke threat stroke what. I mean, I agree completely that from a challenge now China has morphed into a threat, and so that's really one aspect which is which constitutes the backdrop of China studies in this country. So we'll not get more into that. Maybe we can have you know, another session on breast beating and hand wringing and wailing about this. I'm really curious about this aspect, which was raised by Aram, of course, but more and more when as I said, I don't read so much about this, but more and more when I'm looking at some of the writings coming out of the West, this argument that which you say that you don't subscribe to, but it's being heard more and more, that the PLA doesn't have actually much battle experience, and that they are pushing for this Taiwan, which is probably going to be testing out their you know, one way, and this is becoming a very strong strand in the Western discourse. Okay, the Chinese of course refuted it, but if we put it in the context of the Taiwan issue, to say that the Chinese stand on Taiwan shows that they are ready to now go into war and claim it forcibly, and link it with that argument about not having battle experience. As far as Taiwan is concerned, since the very beginning, the Chinese have taken a very consistent position.
Yes.
We reserve the right to use force to liberate Taiwan in case of ABCD. So I don't see why at this point, why this link between China's need for battle experience and therefore the fact that they are talking about active defense now, and their Xi Jinping has made it very clear that he is going to liberate Taiwan. And, you know, how do you see this kind of a discourse in the current situation?
Yeah,
ma'am. As I said, that my if I can, my submission. I was just using the current thing to test the active defense, the postulates of active defense. I totally subscribe to what you say, that, you know, the current discourse that, you know, China will test it, or this was the opportune time China was waiting for. China has never said that China will not use force, which has been consistent. So even I was taken aback that, you know, when you're reading the Chinese, the 2020, the party 20th Party Congress report, if you see, there's actually nothing new. On Taiwan, it immediately came out with a white paper in August. It said the same thing, which was there. So why so much gung-ho? Even I fail to understand when China has, China has never put a veil in its intentions. And specifically with Taiwan, it was always clear. But to suggest that, but what I was trying to say to them, that I don't subscribe to the assessment, or often, I think so, it's a self-appeasing statement by many that would say, for Taiwan, China didn't have any experience since 1979, so we are much ready. But you didn't see what kind of preparedness China has been. The modernization has, is incomparable. Today, even US says, on especially on shipbuilding, in drones, China has superseded the United States. So a country that is United States is saying, and if we still keep on saying China didn't fight, we are far more battle ready. It is just, you know, try, it's good to brush our own ego, but it's not a reality check for us that, you know, this threat has already gone too big. Did we advance ourselves in that way? China, so because for China, its threat, it compares or it advances itself, keeping United States in mind. We don't even, you know, appear in that periphery. So we have to match that kind of capabilities, and that's what should dawn in our thinking. I feel that, you know, when you're talking about building your military capabilities, it's a different China. And so to say, today's India is different from 1962. Also, we have to suggest what difference, what is the difference that we are talking about. So,
thank you very much.
I think I will come in for a minute, because Taiwan, two things we have to understand. One is the China's thinking about it. It's, you know, there is a lot of rhetoric. So that when he says, you know, we will not renounce the use of force, but that is the stated position of China and Chinese Communist Party. But if you look at Chinese traditional military thinking, if you get a country, you know, bombed out country, it adds to your problem only. So they would certainly like to get Taiwan as it is with all its resources. Secondly, also don't underestimate Taiwan military. Taiwan military is capable of defending on their soil. I'm not telling that they will not, they may not be able to fight a war and win it, but they can actually destroy that. And the major aspect of Taiwan, which we don't look at in the official discourses or in the papers, the economic interaction between the mainland and Taiwan. A lot of investment is gone all the way to China as well as to Taiwan. So the China don't want to waste the money. They are very capable of, or thinking about the money, they are much more capable of getting that place. So they will only, these official projections or postures are just for two things, I think. One is, nobody in Taiwan should think about an independence of their own. Of course, the DPP will go, let us see what is the new dispensation. And no other country should come and involve in their issues. Yeah, I think, how long we can go, Alka, if there is no more questions?
No, we have to wrap up now, because And could someone put the name of the book? Yes. Amrita, do you have a book handy? You can just show it.
Yeah, on yeah. The it will be nice.
Huh? That would be.
Yeah, that's the thing. But I can yeah. write the name. Yeah.
No, we will try to look at the book. No,
she can put it in the chat box and people can yeah. then take a thing. So yeah, Rapaji, you can wrap up now because we
yeah.
have to.
I think I will thank you, Parthu. Thank you, Alka. And Amrita, I think you clarified a lot of issues and you open more reading material for people who are interested. So let us also study seriously whatever we can do, you know, beyond the our day-to-day these things. I hope at least more people will learn about the military thinking and military strategy. But only I will give a word of caution that China's military strategy is not, you know, driven by the modern technology alone. So we have to see the deep roots it has and understand from where it comes and what is the object it want to achieve. I think thank you, Amrita, and thank you.
Sorry to interrupt. You haven't put the name of your book, Amrita.
I have done.
It's not there in the chat box.
I have. Okay. Just a minute. I'll just do.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, that's good.
And it was published by?
Pentagon.
Pentagon. Okay. So I hope Aram has got that. Okay, maybe she has. So, oh yes, she says thank you. All right, so thank you everyone. I hope, Amrita, you are able to inspire a lot of young people to, no, I mean, look at this seriously. You know, there's enough of fluff, as you said, about strategic and security issues. And, you know, this whole business of military strategy is taken far too lightly. I mean, you know, it is not just about the gun alone. You know, there is a whole culture behind it. And there is history, as Paiji very, very pertinently said, that it is a thinking of a nation over a long period which crystallizes in it. And so it has to be taken with that kind of complexity. So so let's hope that this is the start of, and I hope we can call you again for other events, discussions on this issue. Thank you so much, Amrita. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, ma'am. Thank you so much, sir. Also, not to forget, I've been ma'am's student. So if I'm speaking today, you know what went into the training. So that I could, yeah, thank you so much, ma'am, for this opportunity. Truly.
It was wonderful. Ma'am. Wonderful having you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you very much. Bye. Bye.